Thanks, everyone, for being here, those of you who are in front of me and those of you who are behind me. Thanks so much to Bernd and the Hakave for the invitation. It's a pleasure and a real honor to be in the round here after such a fantastic talk by Hito Steyer and before a great talk by Tom Mitchell. I'm very pleased and honored to be here. So my talk has this strange title, So Many Pictures of Food, and that's meant to make you ask, well, what's this about? Originally, the title was much more ominous and slightly grandiose, the image of the cosmos in the era of predatory capitalism, but that seemed like a little too much to try to live up to and also a little bit scary, so you've been spared that. It's part of a book called Cosmograms, How to Do Things with Worlds. This book will retell the history of modern science, concentrating on images that are used to represent the cosmos. Now, these can be images, paintings, but also buildings, songs, poems. Frequently, cosmograms are associated with religion, but the sciences are also in the business of drawing images of the universe. Science, however, usually downplays the performative or world-making aspect of its cosmograms, because the ideology of science is that it just presents the world as it is. It's not doing any making. So in order to show how science has actually had a very fundamental role in transforming the world, this book looks at the politics and pragmatics of scientific cosmograms, how they were imposed and instituted in the face of rival and alternative images of the world. It will pass through the scientific revolution and the encounter between magical and mechanical world pictures. From gardens, museums, and encyclopedias and world's fairs, it will move to the 20th century with its screens and simulations, which aim to picture and control the planet through the technocratic neutrality of the view from above. My method is to use clashes between cosmograms from both within the West and from outside of it to trace how some people came to say in certain situations that the universe and the best way of knowing the universe was mechanical, material, and objective. Now, when we bring the story up to the present, things get a little stickier. In the age of the Anthropocene, we're increasingly aware that our ways of knowing nature alter it and transform it. We're remaking the planet, even if in tiny ways, every time we drive in a car, turn on a light bulb, or eat a meal. The image of now folds in on itself, with Heisenberg observer effects scaled up from the subatomic to the cosmic. As a result of our mixing ourselves with nature, nature now behaves unpredictably and catastrophically, often as a result of our very efforts to control and overcome it. At the same time, this is a nature that we have made. Cosmograms for the present would have to connect the dots between the technical, the cultural, the economic, and ecological systems of the planet. They would also have to show how the acts of communicating that cosmos are bound up with recreating it. I'd also want there to be a utopian dimension, at least glimpse one, how from the present sense of crisis and diminishment, new pathways might be seen. So while chewing on these questions one day, knowing I had to write this talk, I was sitting in a cafe staring into space, and I saw my fellow customers checking their phones, typing messages, typing in updates, and from time to time, when their food arrived, they took pictures of it. In this extremely ordinary situation, it seemed to me possible that what I was seeing was an image of the cosmos being drawn. An ongoing and constantly updated declaration about what there is in the universe, where we stand in relation to it, how we share it, the ways in which we participate in its making. I tried to imagine all the places across the world at that very moment celebrating the universe over the course of that day with people taking pictures of food, sending them, posting them, trying to get the best angle, contemplating them, inspecting them, liking them, commenting on them, and being bored with them. So many pictures of food. So what if we tried to map the universe that we're in and that we're making by following this banal but extremely strange technological ritual? What is going on in these acts of meta-consumption when we invite people to consume images of consumables on the verge of being consumed? It's a way for humans to relate to their conditions of existence, telling each other who they are by telling them what they eat, where, and when. They also obliquely register the technologies and corporate forms that house them. They're superimposing the web of information technologies and their corporations onto the web of food production. The platforms of Instagram, Facebook, and Snapchat are adapted to these shots. The internet protocols allow for the quick transfer and uploading of them across multiple formats. The visual dimension of food has always been part of its appeal, of course, but it now takes on far greater importance. Some restaurants tried banning food photos a few years back, but now managers, servers, and chefs know that the life of their restaurant may well depend on the immortalization of their ephemeral creations in photographs. Some restaurants have redesigned their lighting to fit the visual requirements of the smartphone camera. Guides for taking mouth-watering pictures of foods are easily found. And if you had been in London just this weekend, you could have taken part of a workshop on food styling, how to take mouth-watering pictures of food for your blog, menu, or portfolio to become expert at the technique. Food itself starts to change. Like spice, corn, and sugar over the previous centuries, we now see photogenic products rise in demand. Halloumi, pork belly sliders, and the ubiquitous deracinated avocado. The avocado's full spectrum dominance of the internet of food silently testifies to intensive monoculture, contested water supplies, hard labor, soil treatment, and pesticides. A supply chain of refrigerated shipping, storage, distribution, packaging, and advertising that shapes and funnels these healthy fats and saturated colors to both plates and screens worldwide. So we have to superimpose the cosmogram of a media system onto that of a food chain and a supply system to see in these pictures a globally distributed eco-technical niche which is woven through with surveillance and accounting. Another internet superstar is coffee, with a whole discipline of coffee art, where the delicate fronds of foam harmonize with muted pastels, exposed wood and brick, and textured organic mid-century minimalism to create a smoothly uniform experience. This is the meat space equivalent of digital connectivity. The caffeine delivery system that this represents is now plugged into interchangeable urban landscapes worldwide, in financial districts, startup neighborhoods, universities and knowledge hubs, shopping malls of all forms and sizes, where the jolts of adrenaline and dopamine that are triggered by these little cups of joy become indispensable accelerators of productivity. At every turn of the day, we've been invited over the years to join the coffee achievers.
You are the new American society, the movers and the shakers.
Hold on tight to your dream.
You are the new coffee generation.
Because coffee lets you calm yourself down and picks you up. Coffee gives you the serenity to dream it and the vitality to do it. No other drink does that like coffee.
Join the Coffee Achievers.
Keep rocking.
So I'm sure everyone in this room has joined the Coffee Achievers and are still rocking today. But at the same time, we've been getting high on our own supply. The very productivity that these roots have fueled is creating catastrophic side effects: climate change, flooding, droughts, failed crops that threaten the product and the entire system. Even the act of taking pictures of food has significant environmental consequences. If printed, daily photos would fill a warehouse. I asked the historian of computing, Nathan Ensminger, for a rough back-of-the-envelope estimate of the energy cost of storing pictures of food. Now, of course, this has to be taken with a grain of salt or a pinch of sugar. One study shows that 69% of millennials take food pictures, and even if only 0.1% of the pictures online are food-related, the output of energy that would be required to store those pictures would be 1 gigawatt. That's the output of one nuclear power plant working for 10 days, okay, for one day to hold the pictures of food that are out there in the cloud. So taking pictures of food obviously has many consequences. I see it as a kind of cosmogram that connects these dots, which shows how our aesthetics, our technology, and consumption are woven into economic, political, and economic systems and pathways, and that these roots add up to making a universe. But I find there can be something a bit frantic in trying to follow the data, follow the objects, follow the consumption, follow the energy, that there's something in that acquisitiveness that's directly in line with the predatory rhythms of contemporary capitalism. On the one hand, it's very important to get our heads around these complex global entanglements, but I think it's also worthwhile to try once in a while to get them out of our heads, to disconnect at times from this urgency, this tension, this hunger and fear. So I want to risk a bit of embarrassing realism, perhaps, and pause from this image and data flood and this information flood and see for a moment if you'll join me in trying something slightly different, to come at these questions from another angle, to see if we can picture some of the salient aspects of this cosmos that's being created in a different way, if only for a few minutes, to get them off of these screens and onto other screens. So we're going to lower the lights just for a second here. They're already pretty low, but a little lower wouldn't be bad. And I want to invite you to settle into your seat and breathe in and breathe out. I'm not going to change this slide, so it'll be there when you come back. So you're free to comfortably close your eyes for a moment, if you like. And just relax. And let go of some of the tension that you're carrying. Just be aware of your breathing, the breath going in and going out. Feel your legs against your seat. Just drop into where you are right now. Now I want to ask you to bring to mind a specific image, a slice of chocolate cake. Try to see it on a plate in front of you, its color, its texture, how it holds together. Maybe you can recall what it smells like. Breathe that in. Breathe it into your lungs and your chest. See, if you can, how that makes you feel. Is there a sense of appetite, the hunger or desire of wanting to eat that image of a chocolate cake? Now, take a bite. Taste its flavors, feel the temperature, the texture as you chew and swallow, the smell and taste and feeling, the sense of pleasure, the sense of desire meeting its object. You might also pick up a slightly nervous, unsatisfied, on-edge feeling, the sense of wanting more. Maybe that first bite wasn't enough. Can you bring together those sensations and feelings, the smell and color and texture and flavor, the enjoyment and the wanting more. See if you can feel the whole bundle of scents and feelings as a kind of bouquet, gathered up together, and bring it in with your breath. Let it expand, let it fill up your whole body. Feel that bouquet seeping into your shoulders, down your arms, down to your fingers. Feel that cloud of senses moving down through your hips, the length of your legs, down to the soles of your feet. See if you can feel that bouquet of flavors and colors and smells and appetite in your stomach. Feel it in your head. Feel it spread out over your whole body, from the top of your head down to the tips of your toes. Now, picture that cake in front of you again. And let's try to follow it backwards. See it arrive on the table. Who put it there? How was it put on the plate? Who took it out of the oven? Who baked it? Who weighed the ingredients, stirred them? Picture the heat and electricity going back through the wires, back to the power plant, the coal, the earth. Now think the ingredients back into their packaging. Picture them going back to the shop, onto the shelves, onto a crate, a truck, a distribution center, onto a plane or a ship, a loading dock. Back to the workers, sorting the cocoa beans, the flour, the eggs, the butter and milk, hauling them from a harvester or eggs from a chicken battery, milking the cows, picking beans from plants, watering and feeding the plants and grains. See them growing in reverse till they're just a baby cow, a chick, a sprout, a seed. Picture those tender, fragile young animals and plants and let them be. Just let them sink down back into the earth. Let them go. Now bring that piece of cake back in front of you. Try to bring back that bouquet of color and texture and flavor. And again, fill yourself up with that feeling. Maybe with a small sense of contentment. Let yourself fill up with the thought and the wish, may I be happy. May I be free from fear and danger. Now picture all these circuits and pathways we've gone down. All the lines connecting you and this food to the world, and everyone else, all the other beings connected to those lines. Send out that same wish to them. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free from fear and danger. May they live with ease. Let that bouquet of enjoyment spread as a fountain of warmth and goodwill from you out to them, all the way out to the limits of the universe. Fill these veins and nerves and wires with that enjoyment and maybe a little hope. And give those sensations to the world. Let them go. So one last time, picture that piece of cake. Now let it dissolve. Let it blow away to the distant edges of the universe. So take a breath and come back to where we are, back to our pictures of food here on the screen in this room. And we'll pick up where we left off. Millennia of pictures of food. We can ask more directly, anthropologically, about what people are doing when they take pictures of food. No doubt it's a kind of conspicuous consumption, like Thorstein Veblen described. The Instagrammer is saying, I have the leisure, the disposable income, the taste, the technical know-how to make, acquire, and enjoy these feasts. The digital image is a glowing, calorie-free addition, painlessly enhancing the pleasure of eating by prolonging its visual dimension. But if Instagrammed food pics reference indulgence or excess, they just as often announce Epicurean restraint and composure. Pausing before the consummation may be a break in the action. It might be a way of saying grace, paying honor to the chef, to your Facebook friends, to the Instagram gods, before you dig in. At another level, pictures may also be a kind of primordial act of territorial signaling. Hey, fellow humans, there's good stuff in this area. Here are where the best places to get nachos in Philly are right now. But often there's a defensive edge. One of the most familiar online comments about restaurants is, I almost don't want to post this about this place because I want to keep it to myself. But of course, the photo lets you have your brunch and eat it too. In some ways, this is nothing new. The paintings of bison, deer, and cattle in Neolithic caves have been read as a form of sympathetic magic. Paintings of prey are meant to beckon more of them into existence. Another line of interpretation sees these images of food in a logic of sacrifice and substitution. The picture of the animal, like its burnt remains, is an offering to the gods. This logic of substitution plays out as well, but in a different way, in the crafting of decoys. You represent food in order to lure more of it. Medieval feasts were sometimes documented, and early modern still life painting abounded with food. Like another favorite subject, flowers, which are rare, sensuously satisfying, and fleeting objects of the natural world, and like bubbles, like crystal balls, these were part of the vanitas tradition. Ripe fruit, like blooming flowers, or fresh fish or meats, promised pleasures that were both seductive and short-lived. A table filled with food was a memento mori, a reminder of the imperfection and decay of worldly life in contrast with the eternal pleasures of paradise. But it's quite hard not to see a performative contradiction in some of these works. What was on display was certainly the vanity, transparency, and fleetingness of worldly goods, but also the status and power of the patron who commanded the pleasures of the table, as well as the labor of the cultivators, the hunters, and the painters. The bodegon tradition of Spain and the Netherlands, with its robust hams, ripe cheeses, and sweating wines, was a sumptuous fetishization of the table, early modern food porn. If it speaks of vanity, it also feeds the enjoyment against which it counsels. Now, in the modern period, the depiction of abundance proceeds with abandon. Advertising suffuses the urban landscape with alluring images of food and other sensory pleasures. In the emerging industrialized capitalism, novel sensory experiences, fabrics, sounds, spices, sweets, and other consumables, and the promise of further abundance are the enticement and the compensation for the disappearance of earlier forms of security, autonomy, and hope, at least as we nostalgically imagine them. The world of goods' sensory satisfactions were meant to make up for the fact that it was becoming the only world available. I'll try this side now. Now, in social media, every consumer of images is also potentially a producer and distributor. And this has palpable effects. These are Snapchats from Kylie Jenner. You may recognize them. Her food habits make her an economic power capable of crippling a media corporation. A single tweet that she sent about falling out of love with Snapchat wiped out $1 billion. The underlying motors of the page view economy now reveal a stunning reversal. We're all aware to varying degrees, even though we like to forget about it, that we may own our devices and our accounts, but we don't own the network or the platform. And in fact, we don't own our data. Every time we go online, we're exposing ourselves and our histories to capture from any number of directions. The website Collusion shows the dizzying number of little peepers who are watching you on every website you visit, accessing your location, accessing your history. This parasitic relationship is a feature, not a bug. The buying and selling of user data to target ads is the internet's chief economic driver. Twitter, which just made its first profit after a dozen years, and the two biggest firms, Facebook and Google, make their money by selling information about their users, their users' demographics, online habits, opinions, locations, tastes, and preferences. In the famous slogan, if you're not paying for the product, you're the product. And that's actually usually true even if you are paying for the product. This is what Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism, and I think it deserves such a world historical name. Instead of value being realized when a product is exchanged for money, now in every exchange, not just sales, but any online communication, including posting a photo, liking it, or merely clicking on it, information about the parties involved and the interaction is produced, which can then be sold. It's the move from selling things to people to selling people to things. Facebook famously uses this data to construct a social graph or diagram of each of its 2.2 billion users. This is an invisible diagram, only directly readable by a computer, a blind seer tracing the drift of our distraction through the seas of appetite. But what feels aimless to us is guided by algorithms which make predictions about what we are likely to like, based on questions we've asked and answered, pictures we've taken, saved, clicked on, seen, followed. Our history is fed back into our user diagram, on which basis we are targeted with further images, which are intended to move us in very specific directions. This filter bubble, as we heard in Hito's talk, is a crucial element of the Umwelt of now. We stay locked inside these bubbles thanks to very deliberate attention traps, targeting. This is very much an example of the addiction by design that has been described by ethnographer Natasha Schull in the case of automated gambling. But those sticky environments of electronic gambling are now extended across the web. Stanford professor BJ Fogg teaches courses on captology, the intersection between computers and persuasion, a new apparatus of capture, which shifts from product design to what he calls behavior design. In his behavior design bootcamp, he's teaching students this new message, and his students are pushing this message. They teach programmers how to get users hooked on their product, to keep us glued to our seats and screens, clicking away. Boundless Mind Corporation, which used to be called Dopamine Labs, promises to create new addictions on demand. It gets and keeps users hooked. It promises also to rewire users' brains by adapting to their specific rhythms. Our artificial intelligence finds that rhythm each user needs. It optimizes that rhythm to shape that user. So it studies you in order to transform you. As Kathy Geer has shown in her book, Pleasure, Pain, and the Common Good, these paradigms of nudging continue the behaviorist legacy of B.F. Skinner. But it's now we who are the rats in these cages, and the cages extend to the limits of the world. In evolutionary and experimental psychology, subjects are assumed to be Darwinian happiness machines acting morally only as a route to dopamine hits. User diagrams are weaponized to lead users towards specific goals through desire and fear. Woven into the web of technologies, information, and food, we now have to recognize a food web or pyramid emerging. Energy and value flow from low-level producers up to high-level predators who track our habits from our graph or diagram and redirect them, selling them to the highest bidder. In the Brexit vote, user graphs were weaponized to micro-target swing voters. In a story that's exploded all over the web and other media in just the last few days, in the 2016 American election, Facebook collaborated with the Republican campaign to identify and capture the approximately 30,000 voters who made a difference in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and thereby to install, against the will of the majority, the predator in chief. I love how Baron's riding this lion in this picture. This is my favorite cartoon from the miserable 2016 election. The sheep admires the refreshing honesty of the wild card candidate. He tells it like it is. I am going to eat you. So we're looking here at predatory images. Taking pictures of food is part of this web. As we share pictures of what we're about to eat, our information is being devoured by third-party predators. We've attained meta-meta consumption. Our consumption of images of consumption is being consumed. Now, these cosmological relationships strangely put me in mind of Amazonian, as in the Amazon, the actual Amazon, hunting-based societies as studied by Anne-Christine Taylor, Michael Brown, and Eduardo Viveros de Castro. In Amazonian cosmologies, perceptions of the world are shaped by relations of predator and prey. Humans drink manioc beer, they hunt birds and monkeys, and they in turn are hunted by jaguars and spirits. Yet every species, every mode of being, sees itself as human, as the center of the cosmos. So jaguars and spirits see humans as prey, and they see human blood as the manioc beer that they drink. In a recurrent scene of Amazonian mythology, a man goes hunting in the forest. While there, he encounters what he thinks is another human, just like him. But when he tries to communicate, he realizes that only the other is a human, and he in turn is being seen as a monkey or a bird. The predator becomes prey. The uncanny feeling of being consumed in the act of consumption is the shiver that we should feel every time we enter the online forest. Going down rabbit holes, leaving tracks for big predators, tech giants, marketers, security agencies, data analysts, and other hungry ghosts. The internet's utopia of free information is contorted into a paranoid maze, not just the Hobbesian war of all against all, in which man is wolf to man, but where machines and their algorithms are wolves to humans. Worse yet, we're supposed to like it. This is the world celebrated in this demonic fairy tale. It's an ad for the automated petrol guzzler, the flagship vehicle of colonial nostalgia, Land Rover, now owned by Jaguar.
Introducing the new Range Rover Velar. Land Rover, above and beyond.
So that ad is nauseatingly called Respect. And it's what you get if you buy the car. That techno-Darwinian lullaby performs a cosmology which is increasingly hardwired into us through our online loops, with images as lures and hooks capturing our attention to squeeze the promise of future value out of us. It is a cosmos where the answer to Tom Mitchell's question, what do pictures want, is shockingly direct and brutal. The pictures want to eat you. So the question is, how do we picture a predatory cosmos in a non-predatory way? When every page view, every click, every text weaves us further into this predatory web. Many of the methods we might want to use to describe and communicate this world, or even to change it, to build another one, are the same methods which have been used to create it. Most cosmograms of this set of entities and relations would in some way be part of this feeding frenzy, drawing the net in more tightly. Is there any way we might be able to convey this universe in such a way that we don't feed its most predatory aspects? That is, to show how we're entangled in the web without getting woven more deeply into it. One method is to learn new ways to disappear. to cover our tracks, to camouflage ourselves, to try to become invisible. I'm not suggesting a zero online stance or a personal internet shutdown like the one fascinatingly imposed recently in Bali. Like so many others, I'm just thinking about how to make palpable and actionable our deep entanglements with capital, data, and carbon. One start is here, where we are. When our connected lives are so crowded with nudges and snares, there's something that feels newly vital and robust, realist, and I think in a good way, about simply going out, meeting people in public, face to face, in this new flesh, which is secreted back to us in contrast to the time we spend online and on screens. Sharing space and time face to face is a small but powerful antidote to the jagged introversion of life online. And the electric flux of our brains, fortunately, remains for the moment unmonitored, free from clicks and counters. The most potent images are still those in our minds, the cognitive maps and images of the universe imprinted by our senses, enhanced by our imagination and experience, constantly refreshed and revised. To imagine the world that we are in can be part of the same movement through which we envision a new one. This might figuring out ways, small ones, day by day, through which to stop feeding our internal predators. Trying to find ways to let go of some of the acquisitiveness and hunger, which in the end only keeps us more tightly ensnared. Thanks for your attention.